if you want to start like a lifestyle business, is, you know, the examples that you gave is, you know, really start by focusing on a narrow segment, narrow, you know, category, really make sure that you have, you know, deep knowledge of that segment so that you can really provide value to your consumers, helping them choose what products to buy and so forth.
Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast for 6, 7, and 8-figure Amazon and e-commerce sellers, part of the amazing FBA podcast family. If you want to scale fast, target a 7-figure exit, and enjoy the process, then keep listening. Do you want to grow your business bigger and faster? A free audit of your Amazon business can help you see and avoid threats and find missed golden opportunities. I generally charge $150 or more per hour, but this would be free. You can be a reseller or a brand owner. All I ask is that you're doing a few thousand dollars a month in sales already. Just visit myamazonaudit.com, scroll down, click on Amazon Audit, and book in a time. That's myamazonaudit.com. Look forward to speaking to you on your audit. Ladles and jelly spoons, boys and girls, welcome back to the 10K Collective podcast for 6, 7, and 8-figure e-commerce sellers. So I normally say Amazon sellers, but today we're going to go a bit broader than that. So we're talking today to Shirish Nadkarni, who's got an incredible background, a native of Seattle, a startup at Microsoft. So he's got an incredible background in technology and then went on to create 3 startups with 2 successful exits. So a man who knows a huge amount about the wider digital business landscape. And today we're going to get into a very different topic, which is how to create your own marketplace. So if you're looking at Amazon thinking, well, how come they take all the money and all the fun? Well, look, guess what? Maybe you should be trying to create your own Amazon. So Shirish, welcome back to the show, first of all.
Thank you very much. Glad to be back.
So now, creating your own Amazon sounds a little bit exaggerated, but I guess at some point, Amazon had to start from nothing and be a startup like anyone else. Tell us a little bit about this. So how, it sounds impossible to create your own marketplace for somebody who's just sold on them. How viable is it as a business model? Is the day for that gone? Has Amazon done everything? Has eBay done everything? Is that over? Or is there still a space for that to happen, would you say?
Not at all. I think Amazon is now starting to see some real competition from TikTok and some Chinese, you know, marketplace like Temu and Shein. So I think there's definitely an opportunity to create new marketplaces and challenge Amazon or, you know, other verticals as well.
Okay. So what's the starting point then? So how do we, what is the big problem that we've got to solve when we're creating a marketplace? What's the first thing we've got to overcome?
Yeah, so marketplaces have, you know, the chicken or the egg problem where, you know, suppliers don't want to join because there are no consumers and consumers don't want to join because there are no suppliers. So how do you get beyond that? I'll give you some examples of Instacart and DoorDash and how they got started. DoorDash, as you may know, is a food delivery service here in the US, and they actually got started off in Palo Alto. And what they did was they actually scraped the menus of all the Palo Alto restaurants and made that available on the website. And then they started taking orders from consumers for food delivery. And they were actually turned around and called the restaurant and placed the order for the food delivery. And they would pick up the order and then deliver it to the consumers. Similarly, Instacart, for example, they started in Seattle, and the founder basically scraped the content of Safeway's site and made that available on his website. And then he would take the order, actually go to the grocery store, pick up all the items and then deliver that just so that he could understand the whole experience. But that's how each of those entities got started. And once they were able to establish some volume, then they could go back to the suppliers and say, hey, you know, we already placed so many orders through you. Why don't you come on to our platform and join our platform in a more structured fashion? So you have to do, you know, some scrappy things to really get going and setting up your own marketplace.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I guess that one of the ways that people start on, if they're selling on a marketplace, but as a seller, rather than developing their own brand initially, is they will start with a sort of catalog of existing products from a supplier, distributor or something, and then choose which ones they feel will sell. It seems like that's a little bit of a similar thing that DoorDash and Instacart did. They got existing inventory products, as it were, or services, I suppose you could say, in restaurants, kind of a blend, isn't it? Services until it becomes COVID times, and then it's purely product. And even the mighty Amazon, I believe, started up with a bunch of book publishers' catalogs and basically would turn around and order stuff once they'd had the order, right? So they were a very pure intermediary. Actually, funnily enough, I could think of an old friend of mine. I haven't spoken for years, so I don't know if we're really friends anymore, but he sold used French horns. How random is that? Now, I was a French horn player. Most people don't even know what that is. It's a brass instrument that plays in orchestras. That's hyper specialist. And equally, what he would do, frankly, is he'd look at somebody else's website who sells French horns in the UK and then advertise it on his own website at a markup. Obviously, not a great way to build consumer goodwill, given that both are widely available on Google. But nevertheless, that was how he started. Now, then he became more of a go-to sort of place. So come to think of it, I can now think of three people who I know have started their own websites in a marketplaces, and that you could get couldn't get more niche and obscure than that. So yeah. that actually answers my own question, that I'd completely forgotten that he did that, but I hadn't thought that it was a marketplace, but it is. So, okay, we got the chicken and egg problem. Presumably, it's not just a question of, hey, I've got some stuff, would you like to buy it? I guess people need to believe that you'll actually deliver on it and that you're not a scam artist, right? So how do you begin to develop a brand and sort of trust in both the consumers and indeed later on the people who are selling the supply?
Yeah, so that's a great question, because in my book I talk about EatsNet in China, which was the first consumer to consumer marketplace in China, and they had the same issue of buyers not being being suspicious of the sellers and whether they would actually get the product that they paid for. And so EatsNet actually established an escrow service where basically, until the buyer was able to provide information that they actually got the product, the merchant did not get paid for shipping the product. And so escrow service was a very important service that the marketplace provided in that example.
Interesting. So is that something that you think is still, as a sort of mechanics of creating an escrow service or using perhaps plugging one in that exists, but plugging that service into your marketplace, do you think that's really important still, even now, for marketplaces? Or is there a more generic trust?
That was in the very early days of marketplaces, and people were not used to consummating e-commerce over the internet. And so at that time, it made a lot of sense. But I think in today's time, that's really not an issue. So it's not as essential to provide that service today as it was, 20, 30 years ago.
Okay, so what are the other things that you need to think about if you're considering doing this? Would you start by considering the consumer demand for something, or would you sort of almost start at the supplier side? Which sort of, when you're even looking at the business case for creating a marketplace at all, where would your start?
So I typically recommend that you start with suppliers, and that also to focus on a narrow segment of suppliers initially. So in the case of DoorDash and Instacart, for example, they focused on very specific geographic markets. Same thing with OfferUp, which is a marketplace for used goods. They started in Seattle first and then expanded to other cities. So I highly recommend that you start with suppliers and then focus in on either a particular category or a particular geographic segment.
Yeah. So can you give us some examples of particular geographic areas? You talked about DoorDash folks in Palo Alto in Northern California, I guess, not far from San Fran, right? So can you give examples of, say, a category specialization?
Most people have not really focused on category specialization. Most of the time it's focusing on specific geographic segments. But indeed, it is, it's also possible to do it based on category. I guess one example would be Amazon, right? When they started off their marketplace, they started with books. They didn't start with all products, but they focused initially on books. They established success in the books category, and then they expanded to other, products like electronics and so forth.
Yeah, it's interesting that, they famously started the category of the books. One of the things I think that people miss in an online world is the power of geography and being offline, or that offline element, particularly the e-commerce. I mean, that's obviously got a physical component to it. So you know, Google is pure digital. I guess you sell advertising slots, or you sell effectively organic placement via SEO, but that isn't free either. So whereas on Amazon or other places or DoorDash, you've actually got a physical product that's going to be delivered. But even in other cases, for example, I believe that Groupon started, they basically had a very torrid and difficult few months when they started off. And they ended up making their first sale, I believe, by walking not even outside their block, but they in within the same office block, the same building. They walked downstairs and knocked on some doors, and that's when they made their first sale. Or I believe, when I say sale, I guess maybe they got their first supplier on board. So sometimes hyper-local, like the same building, it is very powerful because you have physical, you know, and a relationship, right? Is that really important, or is that just the odd exception that proves the rule?
No, I think all of these examples that are given are fairly hyper-local. I'll give you another example of OfferUp. You know, they basically struggled for over a year until Facebook in 2013 finally, you know, provided for advertising capability where you could, as an app, you could advertise and then have people download your application. They were able to then target based on zip code, and they focus specifically on the Seattle and Bellevue market. And they were able to create network effects in that small market, geographic marketplace, get going and establish, you know, show success and then raise money based on those metrics.
Yeah, I like the OfferUp example. I think one of the traditional ways you roll out a new business is you do a pilot study geographically in one place. And then if it works, you review it. You learn, you know, A, did it work? B, what worked and what didn't? And C, then you've got proof of concept to go to investors with, right? Or lenders.
Yes.
And so I think that makes a lot of sense. And one of the weird things about selling on Amazon for too long, which is true of me as well, is if that's your primary business experience, well, at least digital marketing experience, then you kind of get used to the idea that everything is national and everything has to comply with 50 states if you're in America, or, you know, be relevant in the north of Scotland and in London. And of course, that's really not the way that you have to start off. Once you're running your own business, you have both the problem and the freedom, right? You have the problem of how the hell do I get any traction and anyone to know we exist, never mind use our service. But you have the freedom of, like, yeah, but you don't have to be national. So I like that a lot. So we talked about developing trust in the marketplace. We talked about the chicken and egg problem. And one of the solutions being to really focus on a category, or it seems like geography is more powerful than you might think. What are the other things that we need to consider as a sort of step-by-step process? What are the next things that we need to do? I guess before we even get into it, I guess we should talk about, should we get into it? How big an opportunity you're looking at? That's one of the questions in business, isn't it? How do you evaluate that with a marketplace type opportunity?
Yeah. So in that situation, what you want to do is look at existing suppliers in the marketplace and see how big the supplier market is. Obviously, you are not going to get all the revenues of the suppliers. You're going to get only a transaction fee. And so that will determine your TAM is really a function of the total supplier commerce times your transaction fee that you're going to charge. So that's how you would evaluate, you know, whether it's an attractive opportunity or not.
Do you want to grow your Amazon business bigger or faster? I bet you do. If so, a free audit of your Amazon business can help you see and avoid threats and find some golden missed opportunities. Generally, I charge at least $150 an hour these days for my time, but this is free. You can be a reseller or a brand owner. All I ask is that you're doing at least a few thousand dollars a month in sales. If you are, just go to myamazonaudit.com, scroll down, click on Amazon Audit and book in a time, and we'll see each other on a Zoom call. That's myamazonaudit.com. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope to see you on a call soon. Okay, and you're getting transaction fee times the total value of the marketplace. And I guess you got to sort of do a, you have the TAM, SAM, and some traditional thing, beloved of business school. So how big is the total market? I guess your local addressable market. I don't know if that's SAM. I never get which one is which quite right. But let's say it's your total market. Let's say you're selling in Belleville and you want to create a marketplace. Another obscure marketplace that's done really well is for not just haute couture dolls clothes. That sounds specific enough, doesn't it? But designs, so sewing patterns for haute couture dolls clothes. And shout out to Pixie Fair, run by my friends Jason and Cinema Miles, for making a living from that for over a decade. So that's really specific. I think of them because they're also based in Seattle. But that's a really specific category, isn't it? But how, if you're going to do that and you're going to create a marketplace like that, how would you evaluate that opportunity?
Yeah, I think, as I said, in that particular situation, it seems like a very niche marketplace opportunity. So, you know, it might not be a venture scale business, but it might be a lifestyle business. You know, it's perfectly fair to have a very niche marketplace. The advantage of that, obviously, is that, you know, you bring a certain level of expertise to that marketplace, and you're likely to have you're not likely to have competition for a very niche marketplace. So again, you evaluate the total TAM as I described, and then, you know, understand what's going to cost you to build that marketplace and see if there's enough profit margin to support the resources that you need to build that marketplace. And, you know, if it's a good lifetime business, then it's worth entering.
Great. Now that brings us really to the nitty-gritty of how do you go about building a marketplace? I'm not talking the nitty-gritty of development and coding, because I guess that's beyond anything that we try and address in this podcast. But what are the sort of basic steps to evaluate? In fact, I suppose it comes to the same question, which is, what are the basic steps to actually build the market?
So one is, as we described, is getting a certain number of suppliers in a specific category or geographic segment. Second is establishing the business model, you know, how are you going to make money? You know, obviously, a key component is a transaction fee. What are you going to charge in the transaction fee is very, very important, because if you charge too much, then you might not get the marketplace off the ground and get enough suppliers to participate. And then you need to establish trust, as we discussed. And you can do that through reviews and ratings. You can have insurance policies and so forth. And then you need to basically advertise to consumers to get them to your marketplace. So those are some of the steps that you would take to get a marketplace off the ground.
Okay, great. Let's talk a little bit about the business model, because obviously one of the classic things we're all used to is charge a percentage if you're selling on a marketplace, or taking a percentage fee if you're running the marketplace. But that's not the only way, obviously, is it? So there are other things. eBay famously charges listing fees.
Yes.
And then there's advertising as well. So what are the other ways that we can, well, first of all, let's look at the business model possibilities. And then second, let's evaluate based on real life, you know, what you would say is advisable and what is not so advisable. What are the different ways first?
Well, so certainly you can take a transaction fee from the supplier. You see more and more that the marketplace will also charge the consumer. So there's an opportunity to take some revenue from the consumer. And I've seen that in many examples, like Airbnb, Rover, et cetera, where, you know, they've charged the consumer also a certain portion of that transaction to consummate that transaction. Advertising is another mechanism to make revenue. In the case of OfferUp, since the transaction is local and people exchange cash, you can't really charge transaction fees. So the way that they started making money was through advertising on their marketplace. And there are, you know, things like, you know, potentially service fees, delivery fees, a whole bunch of, you know, DoorDash, start ordering food for your dinner. And soon enough, you know, from, you know, it's gone from $50 to $80 because of all the fees that they're charging. It gets, you know, quite expensive. And so again, you have to be careful about what all you charge. You have to obviously, you know, make money consummating that transaction. But if you're not careful, you will end up losing consumers because it becomes just too expensive to consummate that transaction.
Yeah. So it sounds like the right percentages are critical in all these areas. I guess there's also the subscription model, right? So that's interesting. So the ones that spring to mind are, of course, Amazon Prime for the consumers.
Prime.
And then there's various things. It doesn't occur to me what it is now. There's some very famous sort of subscription type shopping in America where basically you pay quite a bit of money up front, but then you save money on discount shopping as well. I guess you've got Matalan in the UK as well. I don't know if you have that in the States. Is that a common thing? Is that a viable model?
Yeah. I mean, another example here is Costco. You know, they charge a membership fee, and in fact, all the profits comes solely from their membership fee because their margin is so low that the margin just simply covers their cost, and the way they make profit is through their membership fee. So there are successful models that have been established where you can create a membership fee and make money through that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it's interesting that a lot of things build a sort of critical mass in one way and then monetize in another. You could argue that basically all of Amazon Marketplace is a break-even mechanism, and they make money on the advertising, really. Yes. I mean, it's quite close. I mean, certainly the mighty Amazon FBA, which is probably the best fulfillment system ever built by some margin, is probably a break-even exercise at best. The United States is a big place. Doing next-day delivery is a huge ask, including, you know, Alaska, which is geographically thousands of miles away from the rest of the United States. So you could argue that a lot of places work in the same model. And again, I guess getting clear on that in your business model probably makes sense. Although the only thing I would say is, I don't know about your experience, but with startups, you think it's going to work one way. It nearly always has to work a different way, doesn't it? So I guess Yes. We shouldn't get too obsessed with the business model. There's one other area that I wanted to talk about. We've talked about building trust. We've talked about, you know, how the models, how you actually make money, how to get started and overcome the chicken and egg question. Then the other question is really a few numbers questions. What metrics? You've got quite a big section in your book about metrics, and what are the key metrics we should look at? One of which is famously, even I've heard of gross merchandise volume. What does that mean? And what are the other key metrics we should be looking at?
Yeah, so obviously the key metric to start with is the gross merchandising value, so GMV, how much you're selling through in terms of transactions. The other metrics that you would charge is, that you track is, you know, the liquidity that's present in the marketplace. By liquidity, I mean, you know, how easily you can consume transactions. So, you know, if I'm using Airbnb, I'm looking to stay in a, you know, remote location, are there enough suppliers in that particular location? So the match rate is one of the metrics that one would track, you know, in terms of being able to successfully consummate a search. So my search, you know, for this particular location in Montana, you know, some obscure location, are there enough suppliers in that location? So that's another, you know, measure of liquidity that is very important to track, because the more searches or the more transactions you can consummate, the better the revenue you can generate for your marketplace.
Interesting. Yeah. So I guess that comes down to people are searching, getting a result, or even better, getting a result that they will actually buy. And I guess Amazon's got that down to a fine art, hasn't it? because it's got Yes. So many third-party sellers, and Right. they're very, very good at matching search intent with actually getting a sale, hence Right. the conversion rates. Presumably, conversion rates might be a part of that you would consider as well. Is that something that a marketplace person should be working on, or is that more a supplier obsession?
Yeah, conversion rate is obviously very important. And so you want to track that, and conversion rate may differ based on location, based on suppliers, all of that. So understanding is very important. Understanding market depth is also very important. You know, for a typical query, how many suppliers, you know, show up. The more suppliers that you have, you know, the more successful you're going to be. Your conversion rate is going to be much higher as a result, because you have lots of suppliers who can satisfy that demand and so forth. Yes.
Yeah. Nice. Okay. So this is a very intriguing opportunity somehow. I guess I'm tempted to ask a dumb question, so I'd probably go ahead and do that. It's a bit of a how long is a piece of string. How much more work would you say it is to create a marketplace than to sell on a marketplace?
I would say that, you know, getting a marketplace off the ground is probably somewhat easier than actually setting up an e-commerce site, because with an e-commerce site, you have to, you know, be worried about fulfillment and inventory and logistics and all of that. Whereas the marketplace, you're basically connecting two entities together and letting the suppliers, you know, ship product directly, you know, to the consumer. So in some respects, actually, it may be easier to get a marketplace off the ground, assuming that you can convince the initial set of suppliers to come onto your marketplace.
Yeah, it's true. It's not exactly chicken and egg, but you certainly have that sort of inertia when you start up a new e-commerce brand that nobody knows you exist at all. And then if you spend a lot of money on advertising for brand awareness, then people might be aware you exist, but they still have a reason to trust that you actually deliver good products. And if they buy a product from you, there's a high level of resistance, so the conversion rate's low. So actually, in some ways, it's not a chicken and egg so much as just a straightforward pushing a boulder uphill until it eventually starts to roll, right? So you make an interesting point. I guess it's conceptually not so familiar to most people. It feels very grand thing to do, because most of us are used to selling on marketplaces as an entity. But right. as a kind of like my friend's examples show that if you go hyper niche, like selling French horns, like a specialist type of musical instrument that most people have never heard of, I happen to have played that in the past, or to be doing haute couture doll's clothes patterns. Again, that Cinnamon's mother used to be an amazing fashion person. So she somehow had that in her family. But it does show that actually that when you niche it down, it feels a bit more doable. So, and obviously most of us, you're in a different environment. You work for Microsoft, you live in Seattle, and you know, that's all part of their, you know, it's the reason why Amazon moved there, right? Because of the Microsoft engineers they wanted to pinch, I think. But you live in a sort of venture-backed part of the world. London has venture-backed startups, of course, but for most of us, we aren't going to get there. So I guess if you are talking to a bootstrapped entrepreneur that's going to create what you would call a lifestyle business, it may become a sellable entity eventually. What would your advice be in a nutshell?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to start like a lifestyle business, is, you know, the examples that you gave is, you know, really start by focusing on a narrow segment, narrow, you know, category, really make sure that you have, you know, deep knowledge of that segment so that you can really provide value to your consumers, helping them choose what products to buy and so forth. So choose marketplaces or segments where you have deep expertise and knowledge and can truly provide, you know, additional value beyond what people are doing to sell their products in that segment.
And again, you seem to advocate narrow geographic focus, which sounds very sensible to me. If nothing else, you don't have to spend all your advertising dollars, which you inevitably will spend at some point, everywhere. You can focus it on a narrow area until you've got, you know, got certain degree of saturation. The other thing you were talking about was just to, and this is kind of encapsulating in a micro to-do list, what you were talking about earlier. The other thing is looking for suppliers first, is what you were saying. So how would you go about that if you're going for a really hyper-focused little segment? How would you go?
Yeah, I think in that case, it's a lot easier to get suppliers. And if you can demonstrate that you have really significant market knowledge and understanding of that category, it's a lot easier. You don't need, you know, tons of suppliers. If you're focused on an narrow, you know, category and geographic sector, you can bring in, you know, 5-10 different suppliers and start get the marketplace, you know, off the ground. So in that situation, I would say it's a lot easier than if you're trying to build a general purpose marketplace.
Yeah, nice. That sounds very doable. Attracting 5 to 10 suppliers, if you've got expert market knowledge, then you can at least speak the right knowledge, and the deep knowledge will provide value for the consumers. That sounds very, very doable. Thank you. Yeah. That makes it feel like a doable thing rather than just big, scary idea. So obviously you've got huge amounts of knowledge, particularly about this area of marketplaces, marketplace creation. So what services do you offer to anyone who's listening out there if they want to get in touch with you?
Yeah, so first of all, anyone can get in touch with me through my website, shirishnadkarni.com, or over LinkedIn. You can search for my name on LinkedIn. I think there's only one other person with the same name there. And I welcome people, especially entrepreneurs, to get in touch with me. And I enjoy those conversations. And I, you know, just the other day, somebody just reached out over the blue, you know, on LinkedIn, and I'm just going to be spending time with this lady on Monday too. And in particular, I welcome women entrepreneurs. I have a specific mission to help women, more women, become entrepreneurs. And so to that extent, I devote more time to helping them be successful.
Excellent. Well, that's certainly a good mission to be on. This has been underrepresentation of women in entrepreneurship in the digital space for whatever reason.
Yeah.
As a man, I'm probably not well placed to attract female entrepreneurs, so I may not be my mission on earth, but it's certainly a very, very important thing. And the final thing to say, of course, is that anyone who wants to buy the book that I've been looking at, so I can just show people a copy, so it's not coming out very well because I've got the background blur on. It's called Winner Takes All in this attractive purple sort of color. And I've got the physical copy here. It's about 180 odd pages, so very readable and not too scary. And if you go to amazingfba.com/winner, we've set a redirect there so you can get that book as well. So very, very readable, very interesting and informative book. And what an interesting opportunity. It's so interesting that while everyone's so busy selling on marketplaces and working out how to hack the algorithm that they've created, that you're giving us a rather, you know, different counterintuitive solution, like maybe you should create your own. I like that a lot. So very exciting opportunity. Just remains for me to say, Shirish Nadkarni, very many thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much. It was great talking to you.
Do you want to grow your Amazon business bigger or faster? I bet you do. If so, a free audit of your Amazon business can help you see and avoid threats and find some golden missed opportunities. Generally, I charge at least $150 an hour these days for my time, but this is free. You can be a reseller or a brand owner. All I ask is that you're doing at least a few thousand dollars a month in sales. If you are, just go to myamazonaudit.com, scroll down, click on Amazon Audit and book in a time, and we'll see each other on a Zoom call. That's myamazonaudit.com. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope to see you on a call soon. Thanks for listening to the 10K Collective podcast for six and seven figure Amazon sellers. I really hope you found the show helpful to you. Please don't forget to subscribe to the show. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, please do leave us a quick star rating. It will take you all of 30 seconds to do it, but it does mean we can be found by and help many more e-commerce business builders. I wish you fast and profitable scaling, and I hope you enjoy the process of building your seven-figure Amazon business. Thanks very much for listening.